Thanks. As usual, it's a pleasure to be at BI, and it's been really nice interacting with people here. I'm going to talk today about some work we've done with Lisa Glasser on the constructing a Hartle-Hawking wave function in causal set theory. And the specific model we'll be looking at is what I will call a 2D causal set quantum gravity model, which is basically a restriction, a dimensional restriction of the full theory. So I'll begin with a fairly rapid review of causal set theory, and hoping that most of you have heard these introductions before, but please feel free to stop me while I'm giving this review, because this, some of the key points that are there you may not have encountered. And then I will describe a continuum-inspired dynamics for causal sets, after which this continuum-inspired dynamics then makes it possible to construct something very akin to what you would call a Hartle-Hawking wave function in the continuum. Can everyone hear?
Or? Yeah.
Right. And then that's a very general construction, but then to actually do a calculation, we restrict ourselves to this two-dimensional causal set model. And then I will tell you about some tantalizing results that come out of this, some speculations you can make, etc. And this is work done with Lisa Glasser. So let's review the causal set hypothesis quite quickly. Causal set theory is based on two fundamental building blocks. The first is the causal structure poset, which is the reason you call it a poset is if you look at a causal spacetime and you look at the set of events, then these set of events has this order relation on it, which is a causal order, and it is going to satisfy the condition of transitivity, which says that if X precedes Y and Y precedes Z, then X precedes Z, the third condition here. I'm wondering whether I should come up here and give this talk from here. And the fact that it's acyclic is the condition that you put on the spacetime that it is not does not have closed time-like curves. So we start with this poset. So you take the spacetime and you rid it of all other structure but the causal order, and what you have left over is just the causal structure poset. And the second ingredient is the assumption of a fundamental spacetime discreteness, where you say that a finite volume of spacetime, finite spacetime volume, has a finite number of elements in the causal set. Okay? And this is my favorite quotation, which is by Mark Katz, which says, be wise, discretize. And I definitely believe this for quantum gravity. These two ingredients are the basic building blocks, and they tell us that the underlying structure of spacetime is a partially ordered set, which is locally finite. The local finiteness is the statement of a fundamental discreteness. You're not interested in the continuum limit, or rather the continuum limit doesn't play a fundamental role. It's only the continuum approximation. This hypothesis arises out of a very, very profound theorem in Lorentzian geometry, which is the Hawking, King, McCarthy, slash Malamud theorem, which basically says that if I look at a spacetime which satisfies a particular causality condition called future and past distinguishing, then if I just look at the causal structure of that spacetime, then that causal structure defines the entire conformal class of the spacetimes. And the only ingredient missing is a conformal factor, which is the volume element. Okay? So So this basically tells you that if you have fairly weak causality conditions, you can think of space-time rather than thinking of it in Riemannian terms as a metric, you can think of it as this causal structure poset along with a volume element. The CST hypothesis adds in, because it adds in this condition of discreteness, basically takes off from this theorem, taking the Lorentzian structure of space-time as very fundamental. And as this theorem tells us, the Lorentzian structure is captured very profoundly by the causal structure. And the CST hypothesis is basically that you take the causal structure, you replace it by this partially ordered set, and you get the volume element out by taking discreteness, assuming a fundamental space-time discreteness. So space-time volume becomes number. We have this correspondence. And so we have in causal set theory the idea that order plus number gives us, in an appropriately approximate sense, space-time geometry. Space-time itself emerges as a random lattice generated via a Poisson process. And here is sort of an illustration of that, just done a Poisson sprinkling into 2D Minkowski space-time. And importantly, the sprinkling is done with, in terms of the space-time volume. So V is the space-time volume. It's not done spatially or in time. It's done in a space-time manner. And on an average, you have that the number looks like the volume. Of course, it depends on the sprinkling density. We also get from this assumption of that space-time comes out of a Poisson sprinkling a local Lorentz invariance, in the sense that there are no preferred frames. And this was work done by Luca Bombelli, Joe Henson, and Raphael some years ago. And it basically arises because the Lorentz group is non-compact. There's also a very fundamental non-locality in the theory. And by non-locality, I want to clarify, I don't mean acausality. I mean something where you don't have a natural definition of something close by. Okay? In the following sense, that if I take a discretization of Minkowski space-time and I consider this element here, and I look at the nearest neighbors of that point in the sense that, you know, that there's no element, other element intervening between this and another point, and this point, they are linked in the sense, then if I consider all of Minkowski space-time, this element has an infinite number of links. So the valency of the associated graph is infinite in this case. So there's no fixed valency graph if you want to think about a causal set.
Is there a strong statement that a causal set to be Lorentz invariant cannot be a fixed valency graph?
I think that may be right. Yeah, in fact, I think that I don't know if there's a proof of that, but I think we all believe that that's the case. Yeah. So we, of course, are not just looking at causal sets that are space-time-like. So we would include things which have finite valency as well. So, but the ones that are like space-time would not necessarily have finite valency. I mean, if it's infinite volume space-time, then of course it can't. So I'll describe now a continuum-inspired dynamics for causal sets. We would, of course, like to begin with first principles for our dynamics. And this morning, Maqbool talked a little bit about these sequential growth dynamics models, where you grow a causal set element, element by element. You add a causal set to an existing one element by element. And this growth process would be something like a dynamics for space-time. Of course, although classical sequential growth dynamics have been done, one at the moment is trying to understand how to do a quantum sequential growth dynamics using the so-called quantum measure formulation. And there have been some attempts at trying to understand this. And we've done some, I think we've we're making some progress in at least constructing a model along these lines. But today I will just focus on what I call a continuum-inspired dynamics, which is perhaps what most people constructing a theory of quantum gravity will do in the path integral formulation. It's important to point out here that causal sets are not amenable to a Hamiltonian formulation in some fundamental sense, because space-like hypersurfaces are not very natural. We'll see them manifesting themselves in some way, but they're not terribly natural, and they don't really play the function of a Cauchy hypersurface in the way that they do in the continuum. So the thing that is most natural for causal set theory is to consider a partition function, a path integral, and you'd really like to be able to calculate something like this, where we have the, okay, so here you have the action, so you have measure which depends on some action, and the natural action to take is something called the Benincasa-Dauker action, which is basically the analog of, which is the discrete analog of the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, the sum, so we've taken an integral and reduced it to a sum. The sum is now over all causal sets that belong to some sample space. You tell me what that sample space, and I can just write this down. I can, for example, decide that omega is the set of all finite size causal sets, which also, or the set of all past finite causal sets, something of this nature. This sample space is something that will define for me the partition function, which will go into the, crucially into the definition of the partition function. And this, in fact, will be something that I will, this freedom is something that I will use now.
Is it an infinite sum?
So if I restrict to finite n, so in a unimodular sense, to causal sets of some particular size n, then the number of causal sets is finite for a given n. It is only when you take the limit n going to infinity that you get a countable set of finite. N is the space-time volume, that's right. It's the analog of that. Of course, for an arbitrary causal set, there's no continuum approximation. So n is just the number. It's just a counting. So in order to evaluate this sum, we will find it necessary to do some kind of an analytic continuation. And if you think about it, the thing that we do in several other approaches, or which we do in quantum field theory, is to do a Wick rotation. But since we built our causal set out of a causal structure, there's no Riemannian analog of a causal structure. There's no way to take the causal structure and Wick rotate it to get a Riemannian object. So that's not a very fruitful way to proceed. But we can instead think of a more general analytic continuation. We stick in a parameter here, which is beta, and it'll appear later in this talk. We can discuss it. And we basically say, well, let's take that parameter, and we'll analytically continue that parameter. Of course, while doing this, we are making a strong assumption that the partition function is going to be analytic in beta, and we will be able to eventually analytically continue back, et cetera. And these are important questions to eventually be answered, but I won't say too much about it here today. So we're going to do this particular analytic continuation. And importantly, under this analytic continuation, the space of configurations is not changed. We are still talking about quote-unquote, discrete Lorentzian geometries, okay? And so that's the nature of our analytic continuation. Now, we have performed Monte Carlo, Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations for a sample space omega n, where n is fixed. And we've looked at it in particular in the case beta equal to 0, which is basically just the uniform distribution. In this case, asymptotically, that is for large n, it's known that causal sets are dominated by this very strange partially ordered set. I don't know which is easier for you to see, which has this layered structure and is very highly connected. Okay? And these dominate the space of causal sets completely. And they just like, if you like, one way to characterize them is to say there's just three times in the universe. They're just highly non-manifold-like, and they just dominate the configuration enormously.
Two questions. Do you keep the action the same when you take data to imaginary?
Right, we do.
And is the action bounded from below?
No. Depends on, okay, so I'll say the following. We can do an analytic continuation in a way that will make it bounded from below. I can take each term individually and do that. In what we do, we don't bother about, we do a more, we just use this beta analytic continuation, which is simpler. And because we're dealing with finite n, there is no issue. And I'll sort of show you how things can scale with large n. So in the limit of large n, you'd imagine that things would become unbounded. But there is a scaling that happens that is fairly non-trivial, which sort of protects you and helps you define the large n limit. Okay. So we know that there is this analytically known, there's this mathematical result that these guys dominate. And so there's a very strong entropic feature that is there in omega n. And whatever action you construct will have to fight that. We have just tested our MCMC code and find that our asymptotic regime occurs for n larger than 80. This is work with Joe Henson, David Rideout, and Raphael Sorkin. So we've tested our code, but to look at the beta not equal to zero case is a big challenge, and we're just taking baby steps in that direction at the moment. In the meantime, however, you can simplify your problem, and as you say, you know, you look under the lamp where it's lighted rather than in the darker places. So where it's lighted for us is restricting, is this class of so-called 2D orders, which I'll describe momentarily, which are a subset, a proper subset of the space of all possible n-dimensional orders. Okay, and here in this case of 2D orders, pardon?
N element orders, sorry.
So 2D is, in fact, a definition of dimension. Sorry. Yeah, so it's a proper subset. And we will restrict ourselves to this because it's easier to do Monte Carlo simulations for these, et cetera. When beta equal to 0 in this case, it has a particularly nice feature that it's, in fact, dominated by causal sets that look like two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime. So spacetime is a natural thing to arise in these models. One found a phase transition that happens when beta is not equal to 0. As you vary beta, you find that a very interesting phase transition happens. I will describe this in a bit. And like I said, the scaling, the behavior of the scaling behavior near the phase transition helps us determine that there is, in fact, a well-defined large n behavior for this model.
So
okay,
action,
sorry.
So
yes, sorry.
The action tries to approximate 2D curvature, which would be topological invariant in 2D in the continuum.
Right.
But you say it's sufficiently non-trivial.
It's sufficient.
Something with
it's just the curvature, that's right. So the two-dimensional curvature on disk, but then I'm not applying it only to the continuum.
Yeah.
So applying it to things that are not the continuum as well. So I'm not going to treat it as a topological invariant. I'm going to treat it as something that'll determine the dynamics from which I will extract.
And you said that in 2D, those kind of degenerate configurations basically are not dominating the
Beta equal to, they don't dominate the uniform distribution. When beta changes, then we have to see what are the things that dominate, and so. Okay. So the Hartle-Hawking proposal is what this prescription is something you can now begin to look at in causal set theory, because now we have a way of defining the partition function. as the sum. And the continuum proposal, just to remind everyone, goes this way. It's a path integral over Riemannian geometries over a manifold M. And M has this property, which is, I think, a very nice way to describe the fact that you don't have to worry about initial conditions. It has a property that it just has one final boundary. And it's final in some sense, because it's from there onwards, the spacetime is supposed to become Lorentzian. Because there is no causal structure, there's no real definition of final. But the idea is that you only worry about defining your wave function over such a boundary, and you're summing over all possible manifolds with this boundary, and taking the integral over all possible four geometries on these manifolds. Importantly, the idea of having no boundary is that, and I'm quoting from the paper, is that you have an initial spatial zero geometry, which is a single point which captures the idea of a universe emerging from nothing. And this is exactly what you can implement very nicely in causal set theory. Oops. So the causal set proposal is to replace this with this sum, so replace the integral with a sum, just as this Euclidean action, we continue to have the Lorentzian action, but we have the parameter beta, which is our Wick rotation parameter. And what we do is we sum over discrete Lorentzian geometries, as before. But now we also have a restriction on C. We require that not only is it of finite cardinality, which is like requiring M to be compact, so the compactness condition comes in to the finiteness of N, in a sense, although they're not directly, one is more geometric and one is more topological. And we require that the final maximal anti-chain is such that its number is NF, and that's the NF that appears here. I'll just say that in a moment. I'll explain what I mean by this in a moment. But the initial geometry is this single element. So the final, so what you've replaced by the final spatial boundary is a set of maximal elements. The set of maximal elements of a causal set, that means the futuremost elements. Here there is a futuremost element, you know, there's a definition because we still have the causal structure, is just a set of points which are unrelated to each other, to the future of other points in the causal set. But their relationship to each other is that they're all space-like, which means that there's no relation between them. So if you like, it's just a dust. There's no other structure on these points. The only thing that you have is the number of elements. Okay, and so this diagram is basically a cartoon where you start off with E0, you do something, but you make sure that the final boundary is some fixed number of elements. Okay, and this is a very natural way to generalize in the causal set context the Hartle-Hawking prescription. Are there any questions here?
So the finite boundary is a kind of Cauchy hypersurface.
Yes, it's a hypersurface. It's a spatial hypersurface. The requirement of Cauchy is much more specific. It has to do with so I can tell you at the end of the talk why we won't call it Cauchy, because it allows too much information to pass through when you sort of continue it on. But as a final boundary, it's Cauchy in that sense.
There's more structure you could put on and have the final wave function depend on. For example, you could put a metric on them where the distance between two of them in this final anti-chain is a number of steps backward you have to go to find the common element.
Right. You could put a geometry on it, which is induced. And there are, of course, many things that you can even put in now. We have some way of defining the extrinsic curvature. You can put conditions on the extrinsic curvature. But the model I'll describe today is fairly simple from that point of view, because that's what we worked with and that's what we could do very extensive simulations for. It's something that we would like to explore in the future to see whether we can soup up the model. At the moment, we're limited by computational size.
So the sum, the space-time volume is fixed or not?
Yes, the space-time volume is fixed. So I'll just describe this model more carefully in the 2D case. So like I said, we are going to look under the lamp where we know that there's light, and that is to restrict ourselves to this model where the sample space is restricted to the set of so-called 2D orders. I will describe that in a moment. And the action that I will take is the action of the two-dimensional Benincasa-Dacher action. That's what I'm going to do, and this is why this is something I'll call a two-dimensional model of causal set.
You're fixing
theory.
Both the total number of points and the final slice. The final
yes,
number.
The final number I will fix to evaluate psi for that final number. And then
okay.
I will vary it to
it's
get psi as a functional of nf. Nf will go from one to n minus 1. Yeah. So what are these 2D orders? Formally, I mean, just the definition, I'll just give it to you before I give you examples. It's an intersection of two linear orders. I start off with a base set, which consists of the n integers. And then I pick values ui and vi from this base set. And I consider, and when I look at the set of all uis and the set of all vi's, this set is a total order because I've just taken some set of I've just taken things from S, which is 1 to n. So first I pick 1, then I pick 5, then I pick 3, then I pick, you know, whatever it is. But the set is totally ordered. So I have two totally ordered things, which is 1 comes before, 2 comes before 3, etc., right? And I have two totally ordered sets. And then I take the intersection of these two totally ordered sets. In other words, I say that the element of the intersection is such that if I take u, if I look at its, if I look at ei, the ith element, and I have ui and vi as this pair, and I consider another one, uj, vj, then I say that this precedes the other element, ei precedes ej, if and only if both ui precedes uj as well as vi precedes vj. Okay, so this is my intersection. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, u and v are. What is this pair?
I'm just constructing the intersection of two linear orders, and that is going to be my causal set. Yeah. So let me just give you an example. So if I take a sprinkling into 2D Minkowski spacetime or any conformally flat spacetime, which of course in 2D everything is. And consider these three points here. I just look at their u and v values, right? I sort of look at their projection, just their u and v coordinates, and I notice the following for this three set, that ux precedes uy precedes uz, so it's a total order. Vx precedes vz precedes vy, it's a total order. But when I intersect them, I notice that these two cannot be related because although ux, ux precedes x precedes y because both of these are true, and similarly x precedes z because a similar condition is true, but between x, z and y, because of the fact that they're ordered like this, it is not true that even though uy is less than uz, it's not true that vy is less than vz, okay? So therefore, I construct this v poset here out of this intersection. I'm not sure if that was clear, but yeah, I mean, it's a very simple example, and it's basically how you would construct a 2D order out of these linear orders. And it comes out of any sprinkling into 2D spacetime.
These still don't have a fixed valence.
If I take n to infinity, there's not going to be, and that's right, even for finite n, it's not a fixed valency graph. In fact, I will just say a few more words about that in the case of flat spacetime. So the important thing is that though these things arise out of a discrete, yeah, go ahead.
So it seems that these one can count easily. What's the problem? Is it to count
Well, you
Is there
want to
mass
be able
function
to,
on
right,
that?
so it looks like you could count them, but if you wanted to.
I mean, it seems just the choice of these first two sets.
Yes.
It is a number, you know,
yes,
kind of
so you do, but then you could easily get things that are actually just isomorphic to each other. So this can be redundancies, which then to resolve that as you get to larger and larger n is a fairly non-trivial thing.
Which you haven't defined, you haven't discussed these redundancies.
I just mean, so for example, if you wanted to label things, if you had something like this, I can just relabel this, and it's the same object. So sort of higher, more complicated versions of this will arise. So it can still be labeled, but then the labeling, you know, you can get two different things that have the same, even the labeled object in this sense. So there is a certain redundancy that you have to worry about.
And one thing you could say is that there's no more than the number of permutations on n elements. Basically,
that's right. You can bound it. Yeah.
What you've done is chosen a permutation. It looks like two here, but it's only the relative permutation that matters.
Yeah,
and so once you have that permutation, you get the n order of the causal set. But as Sumati said, it can happen that two different permutations would produce the same isomorphism class of causal sets. So there's some amount of redundancy.
Yeah, no, I mentioned that there can be three points which are completely equivalent with respect to causal relationships as well as other points, and then this would be redundancy.
Yeah, that would be a good example. Yeah,
yeah,
would be
exactly.
Case.
So that would be a case where
you, call,
you can't distinguish.
Non-Hegelian.
Non-Hegelian.
No, but a better one, better way to say it is distinguishing in the sense of causal structure, future and past distinguishing space-time. So causal set, which whose futures are, you know, two elements have the same futures and past, you can't distinguish. So things like that can happen, and then you, yeah.
We call them non-Leibnizian.
Okay.
Leibnizian.
Oh, but
they satisfy.
Well, Leibniz came first.
Okay.
So,
all the Germans versus
the
Greeks.
Okay.
So the important thing. Okay. So the important thing is that although you can get these guys out of sprinkling into a region of Minkowski spacetime or conformally flat 2D spacetime, there are also many that you can construct that are not at all like the continuum, and these are what I call non-continuum-like 2D orders, examples of them. And so there are many of these, but the surprising thing that comes out is that the set of random 2D orders, again, something I'll define more carefully, dominates the uniform distribution, and these random 2D orders are really a sprinkling into Minkowski spacetime. So in this beta equal to zero limit, the uniform distribution limit, these are the guys that dominate. Okay, so most of the 2D orders, if you like, you pick one out, it looks like flat spacetime. So the dynamics now has to ask, one has to see how robust this sort of structure is to the dynamics. Okay. So the next thing to do is to describe the action. This is the Ben-Kasse-Dauker action in two dimensions, and it includes a so-called non-locality scale epsilon, which corresponds to a mesoscale, which is required in some sense to damp the fluctuations that you get from the fundamental scale. But it's also more profound because it's sort of describing, it's a way of thinking about the theory where you have a second scale which sets the scale of non-locality, where sort of the continuum structures start to become important. And this is the definition. It goes, this epsilon goes from, does not include zero, but goes all the way up to one. And then you have this funny function here, which has this particular feature. I mean, if you plot it for a given epsilon, it looks like this, and it has this characteristic feature. The other thing that appears are these capital NNs, which count the number of N element order intervals. So in other words, if I have element X here, and I'm counting the number of links to X. A link is basically an irreducible relation between two elements of the causal set, meaning I can't, there's no intervening element there. Okay? So links are just things like this. So I count the number of links, then I count the number of intervals with just one point in between. Then I count the number of intervals with two points in between. And of course, that allows me to have the two points arranged either as a chain or as an anti-chain, space-like related or causally related. And so I have to count all such diagrams in order to calculate the action. I have to, right? So give me your causal set, and I will count all these things, and I'll produce for you an action. And this is what's, I think, very beautiful about this action, because it has some very nice order theoretic structure to it. And when you, in the simple case, when you put epsilon equal to 1, then you get just the contribution from the links, the one element intervals, and the two element intervals. Okay? But as you change epsilon, you sort of leak into more and more of the causal past of any individual element. Okay? It's a thicker sort of, so what epsilon does is thicken the region that becomes important in determining the action. Okay? Thicken the sort of the size of the hyperboloid, if you like. Constant proper time hyperboloid. Okay, so you can go ahead and now look at the Hartle-Hawking wave function in this particular theory, where you've restricted to 2D orders, and what one can actually perform some analytic calculations, which is what we did, and they turn out to be it was good that we did it because we needed it to supplement the numerical calculations. So we look at special cases where NF, the final number of elements, is n minus p with p equal to 1. And p equal to 1, that means that there's no elements in the bulk. You just have the initial element and you have one final set. And so you only have, in terms of causal relations, only links. You have n minus 1 links, and that goes into your action. You can calculate the Hartle-Hawking wave function up to normalization A. Okay? When you look at p equal to 2, then you have one single bulk element. And I don't know if it's clear to you there, is it? At least it's there on the screen behind. So this is a shaded region. You have an extra variable now that pops in, which is that this bulk element, the single bulk element, can be related to a variety of different elements in the final anti-chain. So it can go from 1, it has to at least have 1, all the way to n minus 1. So when I do that, I calculate, can again calculate the action, but I have to worry about the multiplicity that comes up. So L is a number of elements to the future of the bulk element, and associated with that, because this can be, you can have many different ones that correspond to this L, and they're all distinct causal sets. And this multiplicity gives a number of distinct 2D orders for a given L. And so you put in that multiplicity, and you can calculate this. As you can see, as we get to larger and larger number of bulk elements, we have to get, the calculation gets much more complicated. If you have p equals 3, so you have two bulk elements, then you have the possibility of them being unrelated to each other. But their causal futures the elements to their future can either be disconnected or they can be connected. So that leads to a certain complication. Plus, you'll also have to consider the case when they're related like this. And as you get to higher and higher p, things get really hairy. And already at p equals to 3, we have a fairly complicated formula that you can write down. And I should thank Lisa for helping me sort of get around my more abstract way of thinking and actually get this calculation straight. So p greater than 3 then becomes analytically extremely challenging, possibly and perhaps impossible. at least as n becomes very large. Raphael's, I'm not sure if Raphael, maybe Raphael has an idea there, which about how to deal with that. It would be nice to do this analytically for sure, because then we could do the calculation for arbitrary n. But for now, we say, well, we can only do so much analytically. Let's try to now go to numerical simulations and basically calculate this object. And we're going to do it in the following way. We basically, what this is just the partition function at non-zero beta. And you expand it in terms of something that is basically just the log of that upon z naught. Is this exponential of the averaged action? And this is something we know how to calculate using Monte Carlo methods, MCMC methods. So we first go ahead, calculate this. And then we have to do an approximation, a numerical integration of this object. Then estimate z naught, normalize to get a. And we do this numerically. And we've done it for n equals 50 and three values of epsilon, which span a fairly wide range. So, what, yeah.
Epsilon is a totally free parameter, or there is some principle to tune in?
No, at the moment, none. So I will say, like I said, it also enters, just like beta, it enters into the scaling of the phase transition. I'll just show you that. I'm not going to say very much about the scaling, but I'll show you a phase transition. And when you try to understand that in the large n limit, epsilon is like a coupling constant. It appears, so does beta. And that together, when you rescale n along with that, then you get sort of a universal behavior. So the Monte Carlo move is very simple. You take u and v, and you just pick a pair at random and exchange, say, the uis or the vi, say, the u's or the v's, sorry. And you get a new new 2D order. It's a very simple Monte Carlo move. Unfortunately, we can't do such simple things in the full theory. We have to be very, very careful to get ergodic behavior. But this is really no more complicated than an Ising model. So what does this move do? So if I start off with a four-element, if I start off with a four-element object like this, and I switch 2 and 3, then these two become unrelated to each other, and so I get the diamond. That's an example. All right. Okay. And I can perform this move and calculate a whole lot of covariant, for us, label invariant observables, including the dimension, ordering fraction, dimension, which the two of them are related in two dimensions. We can calculate the average action. We can use these as covariant observables and so on, and the height of the causal set, and calculate the time asymmetry between the different levels, etc. Time asymmetry in the causal set. So there's different covariant observables to study. And some years ago, when we looked, I looked at this particular model without worrying about, you know, without constraining the boundaries. So just look at the full partition function. And you find this very interesting transition that happens. If you just plot the action versus beta, then you have this phase transition. And I'm more confident about calling it a phase transition now, because it looks like, in fact, this regime does exhibit some kind of critical behavior, sort of as like a second-order phase transition. And this basically corresponds to two different phases. One of them is, in some sense, an expected phase because of the fact that we have these 2D random orders which look like Minkowski spacetime. So the first phase, which is for small beta, that is large temperature, looks like a random object, very much like the Ising model, right? But when you, and this is just to say that you can, I mean, we're not just drawing that picture, sort of looking at an example, but we actually calculate all these various observables and check to see whether we actually get something that looks like space-time or not. Okay, so these are, So I wouldn't say too much about it. The second one has this thing that looks, is reminiscent of that structure that I just drew. It has this layered structure, but it's in fact not strictly in that class. It's a different kind of an object. And this layered structure is a sort of crystalline, low temperature crystalline phase, if you like. So this was very interesting. Again, we looked at it and we determined that it's totally non-manifold-like, et cetera. Okay, it's written, has no correspondence to manifold-like behavior, et cetera.
So it maximizes the curvature?
It maximizes the action.
The action, which
mm-hmm.
is
okay. Which is the curvature, right. Sorry, yeah. I should think more in continuum terms. I'm just thinking as, yeah. Yes. So, yeah.
Why isn't it the three-layered structure? But you said it's similar to that, but
I didn't understand.
The example.
Oh, why is it not like this? Because this one has more properties than just being a three-layered object.
Uh-huh.
It also has a great deal of connectivity. This also is connected, but this one has a certain, you know, you have a particular distribution of of this. There's this, I mean, this class has a particular characteristic, and so I'm just saying that these 2D orders, although they look superficially like this, they are not, in fact, in this class. But nevertheless, they seem to dominate for large beta. So,
if you turn the action off, that's what you have.
No, what we get with the action off is a nice guy. This one.
In
2D, we get the nice one. That's right. It's in unconstrained. I wouldn't even call that high dimensions because there's no intrinsic dimension there. It's just it's just a free for all set of causal sets with just a volume restriction.
Isn't that bad news? That the action you choose seems to even lead to similar things which you don't want.
Let's see if it's bad news or not.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there some notion of vacuum energy distinction between these two cases?
I don't have a clear understanding of. See, the thing is that you have to understand what role beta plays. And I think that if you knew, if you could actually say, well, this beta going to zero is a high temperature phase in some ways, but beta going to zero is in fact the limit that you'd want to take when you're doing an analytic continuation. I'm not going to talk about this too much, but I can say a few words towards the end about how if you're looking at the unconstrained partition function, and you look at the set of phase transitions as a function of beta and epsilon, then it suggests that there is something that takes you towards beta equal to, if you analytically continue, then you're really in the continuum phase and you're protected. But in the case that we're looking at, which is the Hartle-Hawking, it's actually interesting to look at this second phase. So let me just go on and say, so here in the Hartle-Hawking, then when I look at final n fixed, I calculate this for each fixing, each value of nf. When nf is very large, which is basically most of the elements are on the final surface, then I don't get anything like a phase transition. But as I proceed, I do start to find the similar dip. And what is very interesting is that, so as I make NF smaller, I start to get this dip. But what is very interesting is that this dip happens not at the smallest NF, but somewhere in the middle. So in other words, if you want to think of it as a critical temperature, the critical temperature is not monotonic, it's not a monotonic function. It sort of dips and then comes back up again. Okay? And this little feature is actually very important in the calculation. Yes, so it's not a monotonic function. What we then do is, because we have to do this numerical integration, so it's rather messy. But Lisa seems to be very good at fitting functions and so on, but she's also calculated the errors on these. So you get errors when you do these fitting functions, but then you can calculate using these fitting functions, you can calculate this ratio here. And so for different values of epsilon, you perhaps need to change the fitting function and so on. You then need to ask, so if you remember, we had, so the e to the integral of this object that I just had. This integral appears. But now I also need to know what Z naught is, right? Because I want to calculate Z of beta for every NF, but I also have to calculate what Z naught is. That's a beta equal to zero calculation. And for some while, we were a bit confused what to do, but Lisa came up with a very nice idea, which is that if you just look at this unrestricted sum, where you don't put any restrictions, and you say, well, the dominant contribution there is just from these, mostly it is a 2D order, a random order, which looks like Minkowski spacetime. So we can just simulate these, we can just generate. And so she generated 10 to the 10 of these and looked at, just counted, frequency counted the numbers in which you get so many final elements, so many final elements, et cetera, et cetera. And she was able to calculate for NF up to 19, you can calculate the set. So, I mean, the error bars are so small that you can't see them here, but trust me, they're there. Okay, they're very tiny. The error bars in the fitting function, of course. But essentially, for small NF, you can see that it's peaked around 4, which is pretty much the beta equal to, which is what you expect, therefore, in the beta equal to 0 limit. And as you, so this is just Z. And then you use your analytic results for the large NF to basically patch it up. So that's as far as we can go. And there are, of course, errors in this. They're not very big.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just have trouble seeing that. So that's log Z. The top graph is log Z versus NF.
Of NF.
Yeah, log
as,
NF
yeah,
as
so I'll just write it down here. Yeah?
Okay, and what are the bottom two?
I'm just zooming in on the small NF values, just zooming in on this region.
Oh, so there's a little peak way at the beginning.
Yeah, there's a little peak here, which is, and now I'm just doing it as Z naught, not doing the log.
Okay, and the one on the right is the log of that peak or something?
Yes, that's right. Just to clarify. So now, okay, so I should, what was very interesting is that we didn't, I suppose we just said we'll do this calculation and see what we get out. But what is very interesting is the following, and I'm going to try to now run a little movie. I hope I can do that. Okay. So this is calculating mod psi squared as a function as beta changes. And NF is on the x-axis, so mod psi squared. So as you can tell, for small beta values, the peak, so as you saw just now, the peak at beta equal to 0 is over NF equals 4. That means the final boundary is just 4 elements. That's where the wave function is peaked, right? That was the earlier graph with a little. But now as you tune up beta, so it stays like that for a bit, and then suddenly it sort of jumps to this value here. And that value is around NF equals 23. And this is fairly robust for all epsilon values that we looked at. So it's not specific to the particular epsilon values we looked at. And so because we looked at epsilon equals 0.12, 0.5, all the way up to 1. So here's sort of what happens in the with the error bars. This is epsilon equals 0.12. This is the peak at beta equal to 0 that we saw earlier. And epsilon equals 0.12, these are all the errors that you have, upper bound errors, lower bound errors, et cetera. And you can see that what's happening is that this peak is reducing and moving up into this peak. But what happens in this case is that the thermalization kind of becomes a problem around here. It's much clearer when you have epsilon equals 0.5. because the errors don't dominate so much. They dominate at the time when you have the dip. sort of corresponds to the dip because our fitting functions really are not very good there. Okay, so that's where you get most of the error. But then you see that you basically have, for this value of beta and for this value of beta, you get two very different peaks. So what are these geometries? They really are what one would expect from those phase transitions, these two peaks. One at NF final equals 4 looks like the random 2D order. And the second one, if you look at all the causal relations put in, has this feature. So you saw earlier that there were sort of three layers, but now we've sort of restricted the first layer to be just a point. So we get something that looks a little different, but it's still a very layered crystalline kind of structure. And it's highly connected causally. Okay. So what are the features of this? First, if I just look at how quickly it expands as a function of the height. So the height is just the height of the causal set. What's the length of the longest chain? Then on an average, the ratio of the final to the final number to the height goes like 6 in the second peak. And so let me just say quickly that what we did was, after we found these peaks, is to go back and do very extensive simulations for these peak geometries, just that those values of NF, and beta, and just examine those very carefully. And so we get these observables from that. And so there's this very rapid expansion, as you can see. Not only that, if you define homogeneity as coming from the causal past, then you see that the size of the past is very well distributed about one these values. And the error is very small. So the average size of the past of every element in the final hypersurface is pretty much the same. It's a good measure of that. But also, if you just look at this, the causal paths are highly, they basically share the elements. Their causal paths overlap enormously. The causal paths share all elements. So it's highly causally connected. And importantly, they're non-manifold-like. And we have tests of manifold likeness. This is a line which comes about from analytic calculations. And we put this green dots are what you get for the first peak. And this is what you get for the second peak. So there's no matching whatsoever with manifold likeness. So it's very non-manifold-like. So there's good, apart from just eyeballing it and deciding whether it's manifold-like or not, you can actually run tests to do this. Yeah.
It wasn't clear. Are you saying that if it's manifold-like, it'll lie on this curve?
It'll have a relatively simple dependence. We've checked it for De Sitter, FRW, and at least in the small, because N is fairly small here, so you should expect that the distribution is fairly.
But are you saying neither peak is manifold-like? One is,
the green ones are the one that is. And in between
curve,
the green one is this blue dots, which are what you get analytically. It's the analytic curve.
Uh-huh.
And this one is what you get from the second peak.
Right. And that green ones lie on a curve which is a test for being manifold.
And two-dimensional.
In 2D
manifold-like. So they very well, they match it extremely well. So, all right, so I'll just end quickly now, in 2 minutes, with speculations and open questions. Of course, it's very tempting to speculate. We've got something that looks like a homogeneous cosmology. And I think it's a concrete illustration how physically interesting initial conditions can be determined, I forgot the B there, by theory of quantum gravity. And that non-continuum structures may be important to consider. All discussions of this, in my mind at least, perhaps too naively, just seem to assume that the continuum structures remain for extremely small length scales and extremely small times. But it seems that certain things that maybe quantum gravity can give us clues. When I compare with the dynamical triangulation and CDT calculations. It's very hard to compare because they're doing, in some sense, something very different. But if they you look at just their two-dimensional Hartle-Hawking wave functions, then for the dynamical triangulations, you have this blow up at L equal to 0. Whereas it doesn't blow up for CDTs. The blow up at L equal to 0 is associated with the baby universe, etc. For CDTs, it doesn't blow up, but it's clearly only peaked at L equal to 0. The maximum at L equal to 0, whereas here we don't. So L equal to 0 is in fact the sort of final boundary that you have.
So L and NF are the same
thing. Yes, sorry, L and NF. So I just sort of, yeah, this is the same as NF. Yeah. To the extent that they look at Green's functions, they calculate, you know, from one, they're of course doing it on a circle to another circle, and so on. We don't have that, but this is just a line, equivalent of a line. So of course the thing is that 2D is not 4D, and the four-dimensional calculation could look very, very different, and it's something that this at least tells us, you know, gives us a direction to go when we finally figure out how to do the four-dimensional dynamics, that this may be something we can calculate. And then that case, it would be very interesting to see if different phases appear, if something that's going to give us non-manifold-like behavior in a similar way. Of course, you can be really speculative and say that, well, maybe, you know, since this is very early universe and it's a small size, then as Steve Carlip suggests, there's actually the spontaneous dimension reduction. So maybe the two-dimensional calculations are important for a small n. It's very speculative. But of course, in either case, if you really want to build a cosmology out of this, and you did get this very nice cosmology where things are, you know, through quantum gravity give you something that looks homogeneous and a great deal of causal connectivity, there's no singularity, you still have to ask, how do you get out of that phase? How will you get to? So there will be a graceful exit problem here too that you'll have to address in the full, so if you really want to construct a cosmology. Like I said, in the large n limit, this is something that may worry people that we're just doing it for small causal sets. One point that I want to make is that even though the number n is small, if you think about the amount of information that's there in that n because of the number of relations that you have, the number of, you know, n element intervals, et cetera, it's very large. So in fact, you can constrain an n equals 50 element causal set to look like 2D space-time, right? I mean, there's enough information to give you space-time just with that many elements. So this beta parameter, of course, is something a bit ad hoc. We just put it in as an analytic continuation parameter. In 2D, we seem to have some suggestion, like I said, that it scales. It helps us understand the large end behavior. So it's just sort of like a scaling object that comes in with the action. But in higher dimensions, because you have a non-trivial Planck scale, Planck volume that appears, that therefore it may be that it's related to rescaling of the Planck volume. So it could have, may play a non-trivial role there.
Like, and of course, parameter.
Pardon?
It's acting like the immersive parameter.
Ah. Okay, I'll have to think about, okay.
But it's not surprising that the Planck theory requires you to have a separate parameter that gives you in some sense the gap.
You're right.
The volume, the quantization of the volume.
Yeah, so I think to have it as some, it's if you can absorb it into the rescaling of your Planck volume, then that seems to be reasonable. But then of course you would have to carry out a full RG prescription, etc.
Sure.
And then of course finally, whether when we define things like this, people, all of us in causal sets always ask the question: is what we've constructed truly covariant? We've constructed something that works up to a certain time t. And the worry about covariance, I'll just spend just 1 minute talking about it, is that even in the case of the Hartle-Hawking, if you think about it, you want your space-time to emerge. You want this to be your initial condition. But really, if you only follow it with the Hamiltonian dynamics later, then you can't, or you don't worry about topology change, nothing else happens, and you're okay, because everything follows from here. It's a Cauchy initial Cauchy hypersurface, and everything follows from there. But if you did allow for topology change, then you could have other universes coming and joining up, And then you have to ask, what is the meaning? Is there any covariant meaning to the information on this hypersurface? And the only way to do that, in the way I see it, in a causal set context, in the context of sequential growth, is to actually evolve it to large n, and then to be able to say that nothing else happens but this initially. Okay, so that's as much as I want to say about it. We can, anyone interested in this can ask more questions. All right, thank you.
Some discussion. There are less than a couple of questions. Well, then, thank you again.
Thanks.